Lake Mead provides water to roughly 25 million people in Arizona, Nevada, California, and Mexico, according to the National Park Service. The news comes on the heels of a major United Nations climate report that found that climate change is supercharging the water cycle, fueling more intense droughts and extreme weather. And on Friday, according to a report by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, July 2021 was recorded as the Earth's hottest month on record. It's a little cooler today in Washington, D.C., at 86 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, it's 80 degrees and just cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering.
The time now is 3 p.m. Stay tuned for Black Star News with Milton Alamadi. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Greetings, sisters and brothers. Welcome to Black Star News Show on WBAI New York 99.5 FM radio. I'm your host, Milton Alamadi. And today we continue our focus on the crisis in the Tigray region of Ethiopia. We've had a number of episodes of this show discussing this crisis, but today I want us to focus on the destruction of the healthcare system and infrastructure by government soldiers, Ethiopian government soldiers, as well as the allies of the Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed. And that ally is the neighboring country of Eritrea, which has also been involved in this conflict. And to help us walk us through this crisis today is Professor Mulugeta Gebreg-Ziaba. And he's a professor of biostatistics and the vice chair of the Department of Public Health Sciences at the Medical University of South Carolina. And he is from Ethiopia, from the Tigray region as well. Welcome to Black Star News Show, Professor.
Thank you for having me, Milton.
Okay, very good. So why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself and how you ended up as a professor at the Medical University of South Carolina, just so listeners know a little bit about who is giving them this information.
Yeah, so my name is Mulugeta Gebreg-Ziaba. Originally, like you indicated at the top of the show, I am from the Tigray region of Ethiopia. I came to the United States as a PhD student in 2001, just right before September 11, 2001. Mm-hmm. I have been here since then. I did my PhD at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. And I completed my PhD in 2006. And then I joined the Medical University of South Carolina as an assistant professor in 2006. Mm-hmm. And you know, 10 years after, I became full professor mm-hmm. of biostatistics. You know, my really the most things that I do, like any academic, like any professor, are, of course, research, mostly research, medical research, biomedical research, translational research, public health research, global health research. Mm-hmm. And then I take graduate students. What we have is a Master of Public Health as well as PhD programs in both biostatistics and epidemiology. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I do provide services. I am a vice chair for academic programs. I lead the MPH program. And I am involved in several committees. In addition to that, I am also a director of the what we call Region 4 Public Health Training Program for South Carolina. So this is a HRSA grant supported training program for public health nationally, but I am the director in particular for the South Carolina region. In addition to that, I am involved with the VA. So we do have a center of innovation for health equity and rural health. And I also lead the MethodScore that is involved in the design and analysis of studies in this innovation center. So this is a veteran-centric innovation center. We typically deal with chronic conditions like diabetes, kidney disease, and things like that. So really my area of work is, around veterans' health, health equity, rural health, and what have you, and everything in between. Because if you are a biostatistician, you got to be, your field is like cross-cutting. You can be involved anything and anywhere because people need you to design their study, to analyze their data, and to interpret their data. So that is, I think, in a nutshell, what my background looks like.
You're too modest. You say in a nutshell, and I'm listening to you, and I'm thinking, so when does this guy sleep at all, you know? No, in fact, do you sleep at all?
Yeah, well, actually, you brought a nice thing. I do get some sleep. My routine is interesting. People will never find me past 10 p.m., but I am up always at 4 a.m.
Okay, very good. So now let's look at this crisis. This war started in November when the Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, ordered the invasion of the Tigray region, which is one of the 10 regions, is that correct, that make up the federal republic, the federal government of Ethiopia. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And he characterized this as merely a policing operation trying to rein in a region which was trying to basically not follow the national law and sort of see itself as a separate part of the country. But what has turned out, of course, is a full-scale war, an invasion in which has been characterized by the particular brutal targeting of civilians rather than military assets. So I want you to talk a little bit about that. But I want also to refer back to the article that you co-authored in The Hill. And this article is focusing on the specific destruction of the healthcare system. The title of the article is The Assault on Healthcare in Tigray. You start off the article by reminding readers how the Prime Minister had been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019 when he basically ended the state of emergency in Ethiopia. People saw him as progressive, as freeing up the space, freeing political prisoners, freeing journalists who had been detained, and also consolidating, or rather concluding, the peace process with neighboring Eritrea. But you say in your same article that that is not going to be the legacy that he leaves behind. So explain, first of all, why you said that is not going to be his legacy, and then we can go into some specifics.
Yeah, I think that is a very important question. I think so that our listeners understand a little bit of where I come from on these issues. So even though I came to the United States in 2001, and I am of course a U.S. citizen, and I have been here since. But I have been involved actually in global health, you know, so my university has, you know, partnerships, official partnerships with universities in Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. And two of them happen to be in the Tigray region. One is Aksum University, mm-hmm. Which has been really, you know, an area of massacre, you know, the Aksum massacre. Right. And the other one is Mekelle University, which is in the capital of Tigray, the Tigray right. region. And right. then another one is in the capital of Addis Ababa called St. Paul Medical College. Right. So I have been going back and forth, not just only by myself, but with, you know, my colleagues who are interested in global health in the area.
Right.
So I am very familiar with what has been happening in the country over the last maybe 15 years as, you know, an observer of what's happening, but also because I am from the region, you know, and my family are there, my mom is there, I kind of pay attention right. to what's happening happening in Ethiopia and in Tigray. So, you know, I'm just giving this background so that people know, oh, what does he know? You know, if he has been here in the United States, how can he talk about Tigray right. and Ethiopia? So the last time I had been to Ethiopia was actually in 2019 with, you know, with my colleague who was the chair, the founding chair of our department to do a workshop in Ethiopia. This workshop was a workshop on translational research, and we were doing this at Aksum University, okay? Mm-hmm. And so during that time, it was, I think it was sometime end of June and early July, what happened in Ethiopia was shocking, Milton, you know? There was sort of, I mean, you know, a massacre, a murder, you know, I don't know how to describe it, of the leaders of one of the regions in the Amhara, in Ethiopia called the Amhara region. Mm-hmm. So the top government officials were assassinated in their office.
Right.
While we were visiting. And then the same day, the General Saare, the chief of staff for the Ethiopian National Defense Force,
correct.
Was assassinated at his home with another general called Gezai. Right. I mean, people were freaking out for me because I am there as a guest. And I mean, you know, they are thinking Ethiopia is collapsing, you know. Right. Maybe I'm not going to be able to leave Addis Ababa to come back to my family here right. in Charleston, South Carolina.
Right. So, and it certainly was not a great way for you to introduce your colleagues to come to this country to assist you in whatever contribution you wanted to make to the healthcare system to sure. be greeted with this kind of news. But please continue.
Yes. So now with this, actually, I even become more, you know, sort of interested to understand what is going on, the dynamics of it. So I start following even the politics of what is going on in the country. So as I start to understand it, actually, the prime minister at that time, when he got in power, like 2018, right. I mean, you know, the Ethiopian People's Democratic Revolutionary Front, PRDF, voted him in to become the chairman of that party. And then, you know, really, after that, he became the prime minister, right? He was never elected by the people, but right. because he was the chair of the party, elected the chair of the party, he became the prime minister.
Right.
And I think at the beginning, with all the actions he was taking, he seemed very progressive. A few people didn't see that really as sort of the truth, actually. You know, there were some people were saying, no, you will see this guy will change very soon. Because there was a book, actually, that he wrote. It is called Erkab and Member. Erkab and Member is kind of a guise word for dethrone. And chaos, something like that. So create a chaos to dethrone somebody from power. And in there he alludes.
When did he write this book? When was it published, this book?
I don't have an exact recollection of when, but this was published before he became prime minister.
Before he became prime. Okay, very good.
Yeah. And he uses a pen name, actually. I'm not 100% sure whether it is him, but definitely there are reports that are written on news media that directly show the author, the pen name that he used actually are the first letters of his family name, himself, his wife, and his daughters.
Right.
And I will be able to send you actually the link to some of the reviews of that book. So right. In the book, he alludes that, well, people have short memory. Just tell them nice things, but do whatever you want.
Interesting.
So I am going to tie this actually to your question. The reason I'm circling this is because it's so relevant.
Let me interrupt you for a second.
Yes. So
when he accepted the Nobel Prize, I can conclude that he probably never mentioned that book. Is that correct?
No, he never. So actually, I don't think to his day he has officially said that it is his book.
Okay. No, please continue.
Yeah. So with all that, there were people who were suspicious of actually his motives for releasing some of the prisoners, mm-hmm. Inviting some of his critics. Or the critics of the PRPF, rather, with all this, and then he started this love with Isaias Afwerki of Eritrea. I mean, Isaias Afwerki is a fascist. He has been there forever as a single, he is the government of Eritrea.
Since 1991, correct?
And that is just only as a government, right? And before that, he still was the leader of what is called Shabia or the Eritrean Liberation Front.
Correct.
So, I mean, if you include that, it's almost 60 years he is in leadership. And nobody seems to have challenged him, or those who challenged him didn't fare very well. They are either in jail or, they are not alive. So when he started befriending Isaias and all of a sudden there was this euphoria for a peace plan with Eritrea. People were like, wow, how can this happen when Eritrea, Isaias Afwerki, is actually daily and officially speaking against the demise of the Tigray government at that time, which was led by the TPLF.
Right.
So there were these two contradictions going on. On the one hand, Isaias and Abiy are, showing all this friendship. Right. On the other hand, they are showing animosity with the Tigray government. So people were like saying, this is not going to end up very well unless something happens, because the border of Eritrea with Ethiopia is mostly with, through the Tigray region. And there is some throughout the Afar region. So unless there is peace between Tigray and Eritrea, really, there is no peace between Ethiopia and Eritrea. I mean, literally. Right. Hmm. So people were not comfortable, and things escalated into this back and forth. Now, I will just quickly take you to 2019, 2020, where, there was supposed to be, end of term for, the previous elected parliament and government of Ethiopia. That was mandated by the constitution. So election needed to be scheduled, and there was an election scheduled. And the reason given to the postponement of the election was COVID, of course. But when Abiy Ahmed decided to postpone the election, the Tigray government said, no, there is no provision in the constitution to, postpone elections. It has to happen as scheduled. It has to happen as constitutionally mandated.
Right.
Then that became another reason even for the escalation of, this rhetoric between the two, the federal government of Ethiopia and the Tigray region. For those of us who are observing from this side, we are saying this doesn't look like nice.
Right.
Something is going to happen. And then the Tigray region went ahead and said, I am going to do regional elections.
Correct.
And they did.
Yes.
So they did all the precautions for COVID-19, and COVID was not that actually very common at that time in Tigray or in Ethiopia. I think there were probably, I don't know, 10 or 20 positive people. So they said, you know, if we do all the mask mandates, you know, the distancing mandates, we will be able to do it. And they actually did. If you see the lines that they had, you know, in that election, I have pictures from that time that I showed to my colleagues. They followed the CDC guidelines for, you know, for
the protocol,
social distancing as well as masking. So with that, they did. And then the federal government came and said it is, you know, void. It is unconstitutional. And actually, it says the Tigray government is now doing something that's unconstitutional. So it needs to be, you know, penalized.
Right.
You know, kind of raw government, right?
Correct.
So with that, I think we knew. I mean, at least to me.
That was the breaking point.
The breaking point, really. And, you know, now if you see, even though the pretext or even maybe whatever was used as a time as a reason was this law enforcement, you know, the policing you talked about earlier.
Correct. Right.
He called it a law enforcement operation to remove the government of Tigray, to arrest the leaders of the Tigray government who went against the constitution to run an election. I think that is really the key brought the current crisis, the current war into the picture. And you know, so many people, what do they say? Hindsight 2020 or Monday night quarterback.
Right.
People looking back now, they say actually the peace plan or the peace pact that Isaias and Abiy signed was actually a pact to attack the Tigray government.
It now seems so, right?
Yeah. It's clear that probably it was true. That was the plan.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, listeners, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM radio, and you're listening to Black Star News Show. I'm your host, Milton Alimadi, and our guest today is Professor Mulugeta Gebregziaba, and he's a professor at the Department of Public Health Sciences at the Medical University of South Carolina. And he's just giving us the background of this crisis that culminated in what we now know as the war in the Tigray region of Ethiopia. Listeners, as you know, WBAI is 100% listener supported. We have no commercial interruptions because we don't accept advertisement. That is how we're able to speak truth to power and bring you these kinds of conversations. But it means now and then we need to remind you to support this station. So I do would like you to pick up the phone and please dial 212-209-2950. And any contribution you make will go toward supporting our programs and this kind of discussion you're listening to right now. You can also assist us further by adopting one of our shows as a buddy. And I hope you do adopt Black Star News Show as a buddy. And you can do so by going to give, and then the number 2, and then WBI.org, in which case the money is taken out of your credit card or debit card on a monthly basis, whatever you authorize the station to do. Now back to our discussion. So in this war, Professor Gebregziaba, it's really distinguished itself in terms of the targeting of civilians. It's remarkable, amazing. You have standing armies avoiding fighting other armed combatants, but rather focusing on unarmed civilians. I want you to speak a little bit about that before you then get into the destruction specifically of the healthcare infrastructure.
Yes. So, I have been following, the war started November 4th. So November 4, I mean, to me, is going to be, you know, one of the darkest days because the war broke out and all telecommunication, you know, internet was, you know, cut off.
Right.
So I couldn't talk to my mom. I couldn't talk to my colleagues who I was working. Actually, I had an ongoing project with Axum University on maternal health. So, you know, no communication. So to me, it became one, a personal issue too, because my parents, my mom and my family are, you know, in the Tigray region. So no way to talk to them, no way to know whether they are alive or not. And at the same time, my project is suspended. So, you know, what I did was, okay, it doesn't look like this is going to end very quickly.
Correct.
It's important that I start speaking out about this. So I discussed this with the chair of my department. I even wrote, you know, a detailed letter to the leadership of the university, the president, the provost, telling them what is happening to me personally, my family, and also my project. And I told them that, you know, I am going to be active on this. I am going to speak up. I am going to bring light to what is happening over there, because I'm in here in South Carolina.
Right.
Who would know about, you know, something happening more than 8,000 miles away?
Right. Well, so, you know, before you continue, I want to commend you for that, because often we think if we're in an intellectual environment and we are academics and intellectuals, you know, we forget that at the end of the day, we are also human beings, and that if we can intervene and make a difference, then we must intervene and make a difference. So I want to commend you for that. But please continue.
Thank you. Yeah, and true. I mean, you know, with this, I am so happy that I did that, because it didn't only help me, you know, bringing light to the issue, but also if you think about personally, my mental health, my physical health was helped by this, because I am speaking up. I am, you know, bringing friends, supporters like you, you know, like Professor Rubinstein, you know, we just met over this issue. We didn't know each other before. So I started to be
You're talking about Professor Leonard Rubinstein.
Yes.
The Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
Yes.
You're saying you did not know each other, but ultimately you met, because I see that recently you co-authored this article in The Hill, the one I mentioned earlier. And that is, but before that, you didn't even know each other.
We didn't. I mean, the silver lining of this war, this crisis, is I come to know actually so many people who became kind of not only friends of this, you know, active, even, you know, working with me, you know, creating awareness about the issue. I have reached out almost to all my colleagues at the university, telling them to reach out to the two senators from South Carolina, the congressmen and women from South Carolina, so that they write letters to them. I was like drafting letters for my, you know, friends and colleagues.
Correct.
So that they can help me create awareness in what is going on.
Right.
Because I knew this is, you know, Milton, I am talking about December, okay?
Right.
You know, almost people thought November 28th, when Abiy Ahmed Ali declared, you know, the war is over, victory, you know, he raised the flag. And you know, I was not sold. I knew this is not going to be over.
As I'm listening to you, it reminds me of mission accomplished, you know.
And exactly that was what has happened. The Bush mission accomplished.
Right. And 9 months after the war started, we're still discussing it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So going back to with that, what I did was, okay, I am going to follow, you know, the data, the information, wherever it's come. And remember, there is a blackout. You know, only some information is trickling down through some of the NGOs that stayed there, maybe some journalists that sneaked in.
Right.
Because everybody was kicked out, whether they are a journalist, humanitarian agencies, were kicked out, and no internet, no telephone communication. So I started to follow what is coming out from, you know, the Doctors Without Borders, MSF, which we also mentioned actually in our op-ed, right, with in the Hill. So they started to report, you know, targeted massacres, sexual violence. And the type of sexual violence that they are reporting is actually unique in its type. You know, like women are being told, we are going to rape you. We are going to insert a hot rod into your, you know, private so that you don't have any baby who is a Tigrayan. I mean, you know, this has come in, you know, Amnesty International reports, MSF reports, so Human Rights Watch reports. So you can see that the signature of the war on Tigray is really around, one, the sexual violence of unique type.
Now, Professor, I have to interrupt you here because, you know, listeners listening to you speak and listeners that have encountered so many Ethiopians in this country, many Ethiopians who are professionals or academics such as yourself, and we see how in many communities like Washington, D.C., for example, and the outlying districts where Ethiopians are very well organized into communities, doing business together, for example, and all that. So now when we hear these kind of atrocities being committed in this war, people are confused. How is it possible that, you know, a people that are so enlightened, relatively very well educated, can come back to that level? What is going on?
And really, I have a hard time explaining. It's not only enlightenment, actually, Milton, you know. The people of Ethiopia are among the most faithful people. You know, you have predominantly, you know, Orthodox Christian in the north. You have a lot of Muslims. And you know, really, if you think about faith and religion, I mean, Ethiopia is at the top. So I never thought this would happen. But what has happened is because, you know, Abiy, the Ethiopian government didn't only invite, you know, the allied forces from the Amhara region, but it also brought the whole, you know, defense forces, every bit of the defense forces of the Eritrean government into Tigray as a, you know, invading force. Right. So these forces came. It's not only that they did all these gruesome massacres, but they were also committing all this sexual violence, destruction of health facilities, looting of universities, looting of even, I mean, destruction of, you know, the Al-Najashi Mosque, which is, I mean, you know, one of the oldest, probably the oldest, you know, mosque in Africa. And you have Debre Damo Monastery, one of the oldest monasteries in the region. So there were so many destructions that they have done. And, you know, maybe right now when I try to understand it, there must be this ethnic hatred that is built in some sections of this society in Eritrea, as well as not the people, but kind of the elite, the government leadership. That they wanted in order to remove the government of Tigray, in order to remove the elites of Tigray, they have to actually attack, you know, the region, its culture, you know, and its infrastructure. And that's what they have done. So you now see the statistics that's coming out from the region.
I'm not giving you... Professor, I want you to hold that thought because we're going to continue that. But I just want us to pause here for a brief break. This is the midpoint of the show. So listeners, we will be right back to continue this discussion. Greetings, sisters and brothers. Welcome to the second half hour of Black Star News Show with your host, Milton Alimadi, on WBI 99.5 FM radio
and we've been discussing the crises in Tigray region of Ethiopia. The crisis is actually no longer contained to that region alone. It has actually escalated, and it's now moving into other parts of Ethiopia as well. And our guest to walk us through is Professor Mulugeta Gebreg-Ziaba, and he teaches at the Medical University of South Carolina. Let's continue our discussion in the second half hour, Professor. You had started telling us, giving us some of the statistics, and I actually also read your article, the article you co-authored in The Hill, where you discussed that out of 40 hospitals, only 5 are now functioning. Out of a total of 280 ambulances, only 30 are now operational. You discussed the targeting of nurses, healthcare workers, and even the hospital buildings themselves with artillery fire. So tell us a little more about the kind of destruction that has been reported from this war from the Tigray region.
Yes, yes. So, the destruction is across the board, okay? So, but we will focus, because that's, you know, my focus actually is mainly in the health area.
Correct.
But if you really go and just see the UN reports, the Amnesty International report, the Human Rights Watch report, or even the European Union report, you will see that the destruction is in all sectors. But now, when you come to the health sector, the statistics that you just mentioned actually are not even my statistics. These are from MSF. Right. MSF did a survey, I think it was in March, right? And this is what they found. And it was a limited survey, actually. And they were talking about this is the tip of the iceberg, because they couldn't reach so many places in Tigray at that time, because there was active war going on, especially in the central, eastern, and western parts of Tigray. So now what we did since then was, because as I told you earlier, I do global health. This is, you know, my area of interest. So I started to collect data about the pre- and post-war situation of the health facilities in Tigray.
Yes.
So I went in and found data on each of the health facilities in Tigray, whether it is a referral hospital, a primary hospital, a general hospital, or a health center. And there, the other tier is health posts. The health posts were all non-functional, so I didn't need to do anything. But the health center and the hospital statistics was available. So I took the pre-war data. I asked it for the geolocation, the longitude and latitude of these health facilities.
Right.
I asked the population that they serve, okay? And then I asked it for their status post-war.
Right,
this was
right.
From February to June, okay? The data that we have. We will be publishing it very soon. So in this data, I have it, at the geolocation level. It's not just, aggregate data. This is piece by piece. So the way the information is collected is to show what the functional status is, where functional status is clearly defined by the government of Ethiopia pre-war. Okay.
Right.
So what we have seen is more than 80% of all the health facilities. We are talking about all the health facilities, more than 80% are non-functional.
Wow.
Can you imagine? Wow. When people see this data, they will be, shocked. War cannot just destroy, as a collateral damage, 80% right. of health facilities.
Right, unless it's specifically targeted. Okay, I understand.
Yes.
If 80% of the healthcare delivery system has been wiped out, what are people doing? That is the obvious question.
And that is what I'm actually going to go to. So when you think about 80% of health facilities destroyed, so just take one clinic, Milton, right? Take one clinic. You have a doctor, you have, let's say, one or two nurses, you have janitorial staff, you have other staff working in that clinic. All these are out of commission. They are not supporting their family, they are not supporting themselves. Everybody who was getting care in that clinic is not getting care. That means if there were you know, diabetic patients getting their insulin from that clinic, they are not getting it.
Right.
If there were mothers getting their, you know, maternal services from that clinic, they are not getting it. So, I mean, the costs, I'm just looking at it from a one clinic perspective.
Right.
You know, go this multiply it by 80%. And then you have these hospitals that are destroyed that even serve bigger populations, even more serious cases, right? Surgical cases, cancer, you know, chronic conditions. So the cost is, I mean, you know, unconscionably so huge, Milton. So that's why when we talk about what we report on the Hill, as well as even in the report that we are writing with regard to the you know, destruction of healthcare facilities in Tigray.
Right.
I think we are, you know, it's not going to be easy to estimate what the cost is, because there is cost that is not easy to have a dollar value on it.
Right.
You know, a kid who died of because of lack of insulin for, you know, and then is a type 1 diabetic patient.
Correct.
How am I going to estimate the cost of that?
Right.
So, all in all, I think this, if you ask me to characterize the war on Tigray, what are the you know, I have hard time trying to, you know, put the signature one. Is it really sexual violence? Is it the destruction of, you know, the health infrastructure? I think, and they are both interrelated. Imagine if a woman is raped and the type of rape is gang rape sometimes, or even very, very violent rape.
Right.
And she's not getting that health service because the clinic is destroyed.
Right.
So they are intertwined. So, and you know, it is really what I call this synergistic effect of the two, which compounds the problem, which compounds, you know, like the seriousness of the issue on those victims of this. And then you have people who are displaced, who don't, you know, who are no more in their homes. And on top of that, it is COVID season, Milton.
Right.
So really, yes. Tigray is going through a lot.
A very
for your listeners to know, it is going through a lot of humanitarian crisis.
But this seems to me like a very special type of crime that is being carried out. Has Prime Minister confronted with this issue, and how has he responded, if at all?
Yeah, well, the Ethiopian government always says, you know, every report that comes out by the UN, by the Amnesty, even the Amnesty International report that came out last week, that kind of details the horrors of sexual violence, they call it fake. I mean, you know, so, you know, there is no way to even debate with the Ethiopian government on, you know, this type of issues. Hmm. But to your earlier point about, you know, why we don't see much reporting on these special, signature attacks of healthcare facilities. But by the way, we shouldn't be forgetting there are more than 10 healthcare workers killed and international humanitarian aid workers killed too. Three of them from the MSF, the
Doctors Without Borders.
So that is also another level of, I mean, you know, I think that is probably the largest number of humanitarian aid workers killed, you know, in that very short period of time. So all in all, what this is showing you is that there has been, a deliberate attack. But these reports that came out on the, you know, with the MSF report or, you know, the United Nations reports, they are out there. But the news media didn't focus on it because, I mean, they were reporting on the massacres. I mean, so there were more than 20 massacres that have happened.
Right.
One of them happened
and
to be
normally
in Axum.
Newspapers, you know, media normally
focus
on those kind of... Right.
Yes, so there were massacres. They have been reporting on the sexual violence a lot,
right.
Especially CNN, Nima El-Bagher,
right.
was reporting on this. I mean, you know, very, very seriously, very amazing right. woman, very brave yeah. woman, you know, journalist.
Yeah. I saw some of those reporting, yes, I have to agree.
Yes. And so with the health facility source, I will tell you what we have done, at least as someone who does, you know, public health research, global health research. So in addition to this report that we are finalizing publish it, I actually organized a symposium on this.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I organized a symposium in April as part of the Global Health Symposium of the Medical University of South Carolina. And right. we highlighted actually not only the war on Tigray, but also broadly, what is the public health crisis of war? I mean, we try to understand the public health crisis of war through the lens of the Tigray War, the Sierra Leone War, you know, the war, some of the wars in Africa. Right. And luckily, we have a PhD student that I am, you know, a member of her committee who is studying, you know, the relationship between armed conflict war and health outcomes. Okay.
Yeah, that's a very interesting topic.
Very interesting. So we did this symposium, and also I wrote, an abstract to be presented in the American Public Health Association annual conference in October, and it is accepted. Right. So I will be presenting on this actually at the American Public Health Association annual conference, which is a huge conference attended by, you know, thousands of people, more than 20,000 usually. So there are chances to bring light to this. We have this article on the Hill that is going to help.
We will definitely stay on top of that. Now, I want to ask you, because very soon we're going to be running out of time, in terms of, because obviously we cannot address any of these issues unless the war itself is resolved. So there have been some strong statements from the United Nations. There have been some statements from the Biden administration. There's been some sort of targeted sanctions. But do you really think enough is being done to end this war? Because since the tide really changed dramatically, with the forces in Tigray now being able to push back the federal army, now Prime Minister Abiy is talking about mobilizing from other parts of the country to launch even a bigger attack against Tigray. So where do things stand as you follow it today? Are there chances that there could be a ceasefire and moving toward resolution? Or do you think things might escalate and get worse before they get better?
Yeah, well, so here probably I'm going to speculate because, as a researcher,
yes, I understand.
Use data.
I understand perfectly well.
Yeah.
And believe me, any assessment that you can offer will probably be enlightening to many of our listeners.
I perfectly understand where you are coming from, Milton. So I just wanted to put that disclaimer.
Understood.
So I think to me, the way things are progressing, you know, the Tigray Defense Forces are, marching through the Amhara region, already controlled most of the Afar region. So it looks like that I don't think there is much resistance on their way to defeat the Ethiopian forces or the Amhara militia.
Right.
That's what it looks like from what we are hearing from reports coming out of the ground, right?
Right.
So maybe... And in this couple of days, we have heard that, President Biden actually sent his special, messenger to, Mr. Faltman.
I see.
To the region.
Okay.
So I have read news today that Faltman is meeting with, the government in Ethiopia, with the government in Addis.
Right.
And his second person is going to Mekelle to meet with the president of the Tigray government, Dr. Debretsion Gebremichael. And that is a huge development in my view, because, Abiy has classified the Tigray government as a terrorist organization.
Right.
And he has been saying the law enforcement is to capture Debretsion, to capture the leaders of the Tigray government.
Right.
Now, the American government messenger from the president is right. traveling from Addis Ababa on airplane right. to Mekelle, the capital, to right. meet with the president. That is ironical, right?
Right. And for Prime Minister B to allow that, it means perhaps he has now had a reassessment of what he thinks of the leadership in Tigray.
That's what I think. I think reality is sinking in.
Professor, I want you to hold that thought. At this point, once again, I want to remind listeners that they're listening to Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM radio. I'm your host, Milton Alimadi, and we're getting this enlightening discussion and conversation on the conflict in Ethiopia, which had been focused on the Tigray region, but is now expanding to other regions, with Professor Mologeta Gebreg-Ziaba. And he's a professor at the Medical University of South Carolina. Listeners, I hope this has been an enlightening conversation, that we've been able to shed some light on this conflict. And I remind you once again, we're able to do this only with your support. So be generous if you can. Please do pick up the phone and dial 212-209-2950. Your contributions really assist us in bringing you these types of conversations. You can even adopt one of our shows, one or more, and hopefully Black Star News Show is one of the shows you adopt as a buddy, in which case whatever you authorize would be taken directly from your month, from your credit or debit card on a monthly basis. And you can do that by going to give, and then the number 2, and then WBI.org. And now, as we run out of time, we go back to our discussion. So, Professor Gebreg-Ziaba, I want you to talk about this charity that you launched, Tigray Can't Wait. Tell listeners what this is about, what you hope to accomplish, and if anybody wants to be a part of this process and to support this, how can they become involved? So please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you so much. Actually, the call for action, I think I am happy that we are sort of concluding our conversation with that, because that is very important. All the challenges we discussed are challenges, you know, that are brought on the civilian population, on the very faithful, hardworking people of Tigray. Mm. You know, Milton, you know, your listeners should understand that the Tigray people, actually, for the last 30 years, they worked very hard to build all this health infrastructure. Mm. From zero, they went up to all these health, you know, more than 600 health facilities, okay? Right. So when we talk about, you know, all this, the destruction of all this, this is something that's imposed on them. So for the people of Tigray to come out of this, they are going to need some help. Right. So what we have done is, well, you know, we are donating some money from our pockets as, right. you know, people who are originally from the area. It's, you know, it just doesn't make sense to not support, not to give some money, some help to the region. But the need is so deep and wide. So some of us came together and said, well, let's start, you know, some effort to collect some funds, you know, bring our friends, our colleagues, organizations that we are board members of, that we work on, you know, to chip in some money to help. And along the way, create some more awareness about what is going on in Tigray. So really, this Tigray Can't Wait effort was what I call two birds with a stone. Is that the adage? Two birds right. with a stone?
Yes.
So, you know, one of the birds is really sort of, you know, the money, the funds that we are going to collect. The second is creation of awareness about, you know, the two signature issues. One is, you know, the sexual violence. The second one is the destruction of these health facilities and infrastructure. Right. So Tigray Can't Wait is really a campaign event where we are asking people to help us, you know, give some donations, some money right. for emergency response and the rehabilitation of Tigray. Right. So right now there is a huge need for emergency response in the area. And following that, we need to rehabilitate actually the, you know, these health, these clinics, these health facilities in such a way that they can provide services.
A listener who's listening to you right now might say, okay, I want to be involved in this. So would they send you an email? Is there a website? How can people become involved?
Yes. So we do have a website. So if they go to www.ed-reap.edrec, so E as in Edward, D as in David, dash reap.edrec.org. So www.ed-reap.org.
Right.
We do have a fundraising event going on in there. We have a GoFundMe. We have a PayPal account. We are a 501c3 organization, actually. So any donation that is tax deductible, 100% going for the aid of the Tigray people.
Professor Gebreg Ziaba, unfortunately, we've run out of time completely. I want you to give, if you want to, feel free to give your email address to any listener who's listening and wants to get in touch with you, or if there's another way of reaching you, please provide that information.
Yes, my email is Mulugeta, my first name, dot, G as in George, E, B as in boy, Z at gmail.com. So Mulugeta.Gibbs@gmail.com. I would like to thank you, Milton, but also today, everything I discuss with Milton is in my personal capacity, even though I am a professor, even though I work for the Veteran Administration. Nothing that I say today is endorsed or you know, associated with those institutions that hire me. It is my personal view. Thank you so much.
We understand that, and we appreciate that so much, and we'll definitely have you back again. Listeners, that is all the time we have. Thank you so much. See you again next week. Remain Pan-African and follow me at Ali Mahdi on Twitter. And make sure you also visit blackstarnews.com. And thank you to our guest.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering with some brief news headlines. According to a report from UNICEF, around 1.2 million people, including 540,000 children, have been impacted by the 7.2 magnitude earthquake, which hit southwestern Haiti on Saturday morning. The earthquake has left at least 1,419 people dead and more than 6,900 injured. The death toll is expected to rise in the coming days as search and rescue efforts continue. However, because of Storm Grace, which hit the island overnight, affecting Haiti and the Dominican Republic, search efforts may be affected by mudslides and blocked roads in the region. UNICEF said in a statement today that Storm Grace is, quote, further disrupting access to water, shelter, and other basic services. Flooding and mudslides are likely to worsen the situation of vulnerable families and further complicate the humanitarian response. The Pentagon announced that it has formed a joint task force to assist U.S. aid in disaster relief efforts, while the United Nations allocated $1 million in aid to Haiti. The Taliban today said they would grant amnesty for all Afghans and called on women to join government offices. The remarks are the first comments revealing how the Taliban intends to govern after the group's rapid takeover of Afghanistan on Sunday, and are being seen as a move to gain support from local populations who remain fearful of a return to the restrictive laws against women and girls from the Taliban's rule more than two decades ago. Zabiola Mujahideen, the spokesperson for the Taliban, said today that there would be no, quote, violence against women in Afghanistan, but also said the international community should respect the Taliban's, quote, core values. Some, like equal education activist and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Malala Yousafzai, who survived a Taliban assassination attempt, still says she's concerned for women under Taliban rule. Yesterday, thousands of Afghans swarmed the airport in Kabul in a desperate bid to flee the country, prompting U.S. forces to suspend operations. U.S. military flights evacuating diplomats and civilians from Afghanistan restarted today, as human rights advocates are urging the United States and other nations around the world to open their doors to the thousands of refugees who still hope to leave Afghanistan. The U.S. government is reportedly planning to hold some 30,000 Afghan refugees at two military bases, Fort Bliss in Texas and Fort McCoy in Wisconsin. Fort Bliss is currently holding hundreds of unaccompanied migrant children and has been plagued by allegations of abuse and unsafe conditions. Yesterday, President Biden addressed the country, arguing that Donald Trump's agreement to cease hostilities with the Taliban and pull troops out from Afghanistan had tied his hands.
The choice I had to make